any women. But it's definitely the truth for me. And here's the thing. I've done a lot of therapy, and much of it was so I could walk through questions like this one. So when he asked the audience who we crave love from the most, my answer was, my dad. But I already knew that. No great surprise there. Then he asked the follow-up question that changed everything. And who did you have to be for them? Meaning, what did you believe as a child that you needed to do to receive that parent's love? Successful, I grumbled to myself. This was not news to me. As I've already mentioned, I understood all about how being a performer had affected my life as an adult. Besides that, the man on stage asked, what else did you have to be? Small. It fell out of my mouth without conscious thought. Before that moment, I can tell you I had never, ever considered that concept before. Where did that come from? What did I even mean by it? I sat back in my chair and considered it for the first time in my life. I believe my father was always proud of me, but he wasn't verbal with that praise unless I did something well. As a hard worker himself, he appreciated the achievement. Simultaneously, because he'd never had a great example of what it meant to be a good dad, he had nothing to go by. He had no idea what to do with little kids. My memory is that as children, we understood we should be seen and not heard. I learned quickly not to make a fuss, not to make noise at all if it wasn't what he wanted. Sometimes he wanted to interact, to have conversations or even play, but most of the time, he wanted silence. As I got older, I was aware of the disparity more and more. Little girl. That's what he called me, and not as an endearment. Little girl, you have no clue what you're talking about. Little girl, the world is going to eat you alive. Little girl, you better grow up quick. Little girl became an expletive. I hated when he called me that, but never truly understood how it affected me before that day at the conference. And not just negatively, but positively as well. I wouldn't be who I am were it not for my childhood. I wouldn't be where I am without the work ethic instilled in me by my father. The same man who praised my achievement might have unintentionally taught me to chase it a bit too much. But you can't blame the past for the things that went wrong if you aren't also willing to be thankful for the things that went right. Digging into the whys of how I behave as an adult are what make me able to overcome unhealthy habits. Take, for example, how uncomfortable I used to become when speaking about my job. If you asked me at a party what I did for a living, I'd say something dismissive like, "Oh, I have a lifestyle blog." Never mind the fact that I built a media company from the ground up and manage a staff of 11. Never mind that our clients are some of the biggest brands on earth. Never mind that the website gets millions of visitors a month or that I'm an author and public speaker while also raising babies. It feels boastful to mention those things. It feels like I might make you uncomfortable if I speak about them. A larger part of why I don't want to be boastful is because I learned a long time ago that I was a little girl who had no clue what she was talking about. Being big while also being small is an impossible task for anyone. As I sat at the conference that day, I understood how that dilemma had colored so much of who I had become. As a company, we have been offered so many large opportunities over the last few years, and I'd found one excuse after another to turn them down. I worried that we would disappoint our clients. I worried that we would fail. I worried that I wasn't smart enough to lead the team into new territory. It's hard to write it down now because I spend so much time telling other women to chase their big dreams. And if you had asked me, of course I would have told you that we were daring ourselves to grow by leaps and bounds. But when I took a real look at my life and my company, I recognized the truth. I was making myself small. I was performing just enough to gain your attention, but not truly being myself for fear of what everyone might think of the real me. Who am I really? I'm a wife and a mother, and I also dream of being a true media mogul. I am working to grow my lifestyle media agency to incredible heights. I dream of having enough revenue so that all of these incredible people who work for me, who took a chance on helping with my dream, can own their own homes, pay off their student loans, and take long, dreamy vacations somewhere sunny. I dream of starting a nonprofit that supports other women who want to chase down dreams of their own. I'm working to build a company my children will grow up and work at too. I think the media we consume can positively impact our lives, and by creating media that uplifts and encourages women, we can literally change the world. I have so many goals and dreams for myself, and not one of them is small. They're big and wild and full of hope. They require faith and courage and a whole lot of audacity. I cannot get there. I will not get there unless I start embracing every side of my character, including the sides of me that make other people uncomfortable. This is what occurred to me at the conference that day. I cannot continue to live as half of myself simply because it's hard for others to handle all of me. I was at another conference just a few weeks ago when I saw this playing out in other women around me. 400 inspiring, entrepreneurial-minded women, and I kept hearing them saying the same things over and over. Well, this is just my hobby. This is just something I do on the side. My job is being a mom, but this is a great side gig. Y'all, these were not women casually selling antiques from their garage on Etsy. These women were running businesses and teams. Some of them were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, yet I heard the word hobby over and over. It made me realize I am not the only woman who is making herself small to make others feel more comfortable. It's hard for people who don't understand us to be fully supportive. When you boil it down, that's the heart of the problem with my father. He couldn't understand what to do with a small child, let alone a girl. Since he didn't understand me, he often unintentionally muted the parts of me that made him uncomfortable. Working women sometimes have to fight their way through patriarchal systems. Working mothers get backlash from in-laws or parents who can't understand our desire to work, while stay-at-home moms slam us for being away from our children. I'll bet stay-at-home moms feel similarly judged by working women who can't relate to their life choices. It's as though we're all children on the playground trying to say whatever others want to hear, trying to hide all the parts that others might not understand. It makes me wonder how many women are walking around living into half their personality and in doing so, denying who their creator made them to be. Do you really think God made you, uniquely wonderful you, in the hopes you would deny your true self because it might be off-putting to others? I can't believe that's true. The more I've thought about it, the more I believe that God made me this way. He knew I would have a worker's heart, and he knew I would want to build big dreams. In the same way, he knew another one of his children was meant to stay home and raise her beautiful babies, while another daughter of his wouldn't want to have kids at all. Have you spent a lifetime muting yourself for fear of what others will think? Are you an entrepreneur who calls your business a hobby because you worry about what your mother-in-law will say, or because it's safer to keep everyone's expectations low? Are you hesitating to go back to school because you think you're not smart enough? Do you stop yourself from daring to try something new because you're already positive you'll fail? Do you remain silent when you have so much to say? Do you believe you'll never do better or be better than you are right now because of your family of origin? Do you hesitate to admit your dreams aloud because you're nervous about others making fun of you or judging you for your choices? Girl, I lived in fear of this for years. I worry that if you knew how much I love to work, you might call into question how I can do any of those things while being a successful mother. I've had too many people question my commitment to my children over the last 10 years, and it influenced what I came to believe about being a working woman. It was a long battle from mommy guilt to acceptance, and I was only ever able to work through it after we adopted our daughter. When she was about 6 weeks old, I had to go on a business trip, and while I was gone, someone asked me about mommy guilt as a working mom. It's a question that comes up a lot, and one that I bet most mothers, regardless of whether they stay home with their babies or choose to work, have grappled with. I've thought about it a lot over the last 10 years of motherhood, and even more so now that I'm raising a daughter, and here's what I've decided. I refuse to teach her this narrative. I absolutely refuse to raise her with the ideal that only one parent is ultimately responsible for who she will become. I was raised by two working parents and the proverbial village. I will not consent to the belief that having a mother with a full-time job means that she's not loved and well cared for. I will not set her up to believe that having a career or not has anything to do with how much she's committed to her partner or how much she loves her children, should she choose to have either. I will not tell her that a man's work is only out in the world or that a woman's work is inside the home. If she chooses to stay at home, then we will support her with all our hearts, but we will never teach her that there's only one kind of woman to be. This is important because her brothers will be told by society that their options are endless, and she will be shown by media that her world is limited. I know this for many reasons, but mostly because her daddy has never one time been asked if he feels guilty for having a job. As she grows, my daughter will learn things out in the world that I wish she didn't. I cannot control that. But I can control the kind of woman I set as an example. I, her mother, believe that Noah, my daughter, is fearfully and wonderfully made by a God who imagined her place in this world long before either of us was born. I believe the same thing about you. I believe that you are not a mistake, and feeling guilt about who you are, working, staying at home, overweight, underweight, overeducated, uneducated, emotional, bookish, street smart, or whatever, does a disservice to yourself and the Creator who made you. There are hundreds of ways to lose yourself, but the easiest of them all is refusing to acknowledge who you truly are in the first place. You, the real you, is not an accident. Those dreams you have for yourself are not silly. They are the roadmap to your divine calling. Don't sit this one out. Don't let someone else's opinion of you determine your worth. Don't miss out on the chance to live the life of incredible possibility in front of you. You were not made to be small. You are not a little girl. You are a grown woman, and it's time you grew up. Become exactly who God calls you to be. Things that helped me. Number one, a willingness to offend. I don't mean offend as in tell a bunch of yo mama jokes. I mean embrace the idea that not everyone can understand or approve of you, including those closest to you. If you're a people pleaser like I was, this is especially hard because my instinct is to ensure that everyone likes me at all times. So, I decided to get out of my own way and stop focusing so much on what anyone else thought. I focus on being the best, most loving version of myself, but whether or not you approve of that isn't my concern. Number two, a bold statement. For me, it was a tattoo. I'd secretly wanted one for years, but I was worried about what others would think. Then I had an epiphany. I get to decide who I am. Every single day we're alive, we're choosing this life and this persona. We choose to be the stay-at-home mom who loves baking and Pilates. We choose to be a hipster who loves coffee shops and artisan goods. We choose to be a lawyer who runs marathons and only eats organic. Every single aspect of our persona, no matter how long we've rocked it, is a choice we make every day. This was a massive eye-opener for me. And as odd as it sounds, when I realized this, it hit me right between the eyes. And the very first thought I had was, I'm getting a wrist tattoo. Number 3, an encounter with a guru. Many times I need the insight of a podcast, a book, or a conference to gain perspective. If you wonder if you are muting a side of yourself or there are things you know you want to work on, start consuming content that speaks to that specific area. You may not adopt every word of what you hear or read, but you'll certainly garner a bit of wisdom to help you with your season. Chapter 13. The Lie. I'm going to marry Matt Damon. Laugh all you want, but this was something I believed for years. I've talked about my obsession with Matt Damon many times, mostly because it's funny, and I live to make other people chuckle. It's also an easy laugh because people have a hard time reconciling a seemingly intelligent, sane person believing that she will marry a celebrity she's never met. But the truth is, there was a time, whole years of my life in fact, when my greatest life plan was to find Matt Damon somewhere in LA and lock it in. I spent most of my junior year in high school watching Good Will Hunting over and over. I can still recite the entire movie for you by heart if you need me to. I applied over and over again for jobs at Miramax Films because they had produced Good Will Hunting, and my 18-year-old brain assumed that Matt Damon might stroll through the lobby at any given moment. For my last year living at home and my first year in Los Angeles, this fantasy of Matt as my knight in shining armor kept me going. I imagined it in vivid detail. How we'd meet, what I'd wear, where we'd marry, what our house would look like, what our kids would look like. When I found myself in a bleak place, those imaginings were the light at the end of my tunnel. I truly believed they were where I was headed. When I finally did bump into Matt while working a party for Miramax a year into working there, he walked right toward me at the back of the theater. I mean, hand to dog, he made a beeline for where I was standing. My heart nearly exploded in my chest because it was happening exactly the way I thought it would. He saw me and somehow just knew we were destined to be together. As soon as he got within earshot, he started to speak. "Excuse me," he said. "This is it," I thought. "Do you know where I'm supposed to sit?" He spoke to me because he was a celebrity and I was the girl with the clipboard in her hands, not because he sensed we were destined to be together. I walked him to his assigned spot and left him there without a marriage proposal or even a request for a date. After living in LA for a year, enough reality had hit me to understand that my former imaginings were part of a childish daydream. Later on in life, I had another fantasy. This one was smaller, the outcome less life-altering, but I obsessed about it just as much. I wanted a Louis Vuitton bag. More specifically, I wanted a Louis Vuitton Speedy bag. For those of you who aren't familiar, it's one of LV's classics. It's about the size of a regulation football, and at the time, they cost a little over $1,000. $1,000 for a bag the size of my head. It was ridiculous, but I still wanted it. I wanted it because it represented the kind of woman I dreamed of becoming. During my first summer living in LA, I often visited the Beverly Center. The Beverly Center is a fancy-pants mall in Beverly Hills, and at the time, I couldn't afford anything other than the $6 it took me to park there. Even still, I would wander around window shopping and dreaming of someday. It was on one such trip when I saw the most glamorous woman I had ever seen. Or at least, the epitome of what I hoped to look like someday. Her hair was glossy, her makeup was perfect, her outfit was cute, and in her hand she carried a Louis Vuitton Speedy bag. Even better, she tied a vintage scarf around the handle of that bag, making it the classiest looking thing I'd ever witnessed in real life. In that moment, I was sold on this ideal. Someday, I was going to be as pulled together and stylish as that woman. Someday, I was going to own that bag. I coveted it for years, knowing it was a total fantasy. $1,000 is an astronomical sum to spend on something so frivolous. But I still imagined what I'd do with that bag. I imagined where I'd use it and how I'd change out the scarf seasonally to match my outfit. I pictured it in great detail, and over time, I came up with a game plan for achieving it. Someday, I would build a company, and someday that company would have real clients who would pay me really big money. The first time someone gave me a check for $10,000 in consultation fees, I decided I was going to buy myself that bag. It took me years, you guys. Years of scraping and hustling as a small-time wedding planner. Years of building up my portfolio of work and my client roster. Years of charging $750, then $1,000, then more. Every time I went to the mall, I'd walk by Louis Vuitton and stare at that bag through the window. Through every meeting and contract, I held on to that vision. For every mean bridezilla or drunk best man speech or late night cleaning confetti out of the hotel carpet so my clients wouldn't lose their deposit, I kept thinking, I am going to get that Speedy bag. The day I received my first $10,000 check, I drove directly to the bank, and then from the bank to the Louis Vuitton store at the Beverly Center. When I walked out of that store, it was the proudest I'd ever been in my whole life. A purse is cool, and a Matt Damon obsession is, interesting, perhaps. But why bring them up now? Why tell you about this random, quirky lie, or this purse I used to be obsessed with, when the other chapters carry so much weight and seriousness? Because I think my ability to imagine my dreams in intricate detail is one of the biggest reasons I've been able to achieve them. Seriously. Don't rush by that statement. Sit with it for a minute. A huge part of my success is built into my imagination. And I don't mean Tim Burton-style imagination. I just mean the ability to pick out a daydream and then focus on it, sometimes for years. One of the questions I get most often is how I stay motivated. Lately, I've been trying to offer tangible ideas. Surround yourself with inspiring people, both in real life and in your social media feeds. Listen to motivational podcasts. Blast pump-up jams until you're feeling inspired. Figure out a formula for what motivates you, then do it again and again. But that may sound like advice you've probably heard before. So what's the point of repeating information that won't stick? I'd rather hone in on what's going to make the big difference for you, even if it might sound a little strange. For me, the big difference was envisioning a very specific future. Believing I would marry Matt Damon was borderline crazy, but it got me to LA, and it led me to fighting for getting a job at Miramax Films, which led me to both my career as an event planner and my future husband. In the absence of clear direction or real vision, I just imagined one. I latched on to the idea of a future so I knew a direction to walk in. Along the way, I grew up and learned about my destination, but had I not held that idea in my head, who knows where I would have gone? Or more importantly, how I would have mentally escaped the hard times while I was still inside of them. When I was dreaming about that purse, my larger goals of making a decent salary and contributing to the bank account I shared with my new husband seemed overwhelming. They didn't feel tangible. But breaking it down into a bite-sized goal, in my case, buying a purse, was achievable. Calling your shot is powerful when you're chasing down a dream, but it's also not enough. You have to spend real time focusing on everything you can about that dream. What does it look like? What does it feel like? How much detail can you imagine? How real can you make it in your own mind? Because here's the deal. My goals are real to me. There isn't a single doubt or a question in my mind that I can achieve them. I have absolute certainty. The same way I did with Matt or that ridiculously expensive handbag. Whether or not the dream ultimately comes true isn't the point. The point is, how do you steer your ship in a clear direction? How do you stay on course even when the water is choppy or the boat is crashing on the rocks? You do that by keeping your eyes on the horizon. For me, my daydreams were an attempt to keep my eyes above the waves. When life was hard and murky and difficult to navigate, having a clear vision gave me something to focus on. I can't recommend it enough for you. Do you have a goal for yourself? I'll tell you again. Write it down. No, seriously. Write it down. Imagine it in intricate detail. Focus on it whenever you can. What will it feel like to get healthy? How will your clothes fit? Or how about your dream job? What will your first day at that company be like? How about the 50th? What will you be able to do in your free time because you have that position? How much happier will you be? I like visuals as well. I keep my visual reminders of my current goals taped up inside my closet so every single time I get dressed, which is daily, yo, I see them as a reminder. What are they? I knew you'd ask. One is the cover of Forbes with the top female self-made millionaires. The second is a picture of a vacation home in Hawaii. Both have been on my wish list for years. The house in particular feels extra dreamy but hard to achieve. My goal is to own it by the time I'm 40. So I've got 5 years. You guys, I can't tell you how often I felt tired or discouraged or whatever, and I've closed my eyes and imagined my 40th birthday party at that house in Hawaii that I've dreamed up. My friends, my kids, my husband, and my family are there, and we're all drinking some fabulous cocktail. I'm wearing a gorgeous caftan of some kind, because when you make enough money to buy your own Hawaiian vacation home, you can wear whatever you want, and there's no way I'm restricting my midsection. That birthday party and that house are crystal clear in my mind. They help me focus when I get bogged down. Sometimes these daydreams work as a distraction technique too. When I'm running long distance or training for a race, my imagination is a stellar tool for focusing on something else. Back when I trained for my first half marathon, my only goal was just to finish without dying. The next time around, the goal was to run those 13 miles faster than I did the time before. That meant training often and well, doing long runs and tempo runs and pushing myself each time. It's hard, y'all, and it hurt muscles I hadn't used since I did step aerobics back in the 90s. When I run, I use this trick for getting through any strenuous workout, and you're free to use it too. It's utterly ridiculous and even a little embarrassing, but it works for me every time. I believe Mindy Kaling coins the phrase cardio fantasies, how she invents stories to entertain herself as she exercises. If she didn't, someone please trademark that for me and I'll turn it into my next book and a line of activewear. My cardio fantasy is the big, crazy dream I typically imagine myself in during a particularly difficult workout. Sometimes the music in my headphones can get me through, but when the going gets tough, the tough, that's me in this scenario, imagines herself vacationing with George Clooney at his house in Lake Como. Laugh at me all you want, but I found that the more outlandish the cardio fantasy, the more time I can pass without noticing that my quads are screaming. Don't have your own cardio fantasy? Borrow one of mine. These are, no, seriously, my go-tos. You think I'm trying to be funny here, but I swear by the power of Grayskull, these are really what I'm thinking about. Be friends with your hero. As you may or may not know, I am the biggest book nerd you've ever met in your whole life. Don't even start a book conversation with me unless you really want to take it to level 5, because I will embarrass myself. There's no author on earth I want to meet more than Deborah Harkness. Because I'm a super nerd, I also know that she lives relatively nearish my weekly running spot. I like to imagine a detailed scenario where she's on the same trail I am, and I recognize her, and we basically become best friends, and we meet weekly to walk and discuss the intricate plot points of her next book. Vacationing with celebrities. I wasn't kidding about the George Clooney thing. I like to imagine I'm part of a large collection of celebrity couples, and we're all vacationing somewhere amazing. In the same scenario, my hair is always shiny and my makeup a dewy J-Lo-like special. I make everyone dinner and surprisingly, even the super skinny movie stars like meatloaf and casseroles. They ask where they can get my cookbook and they all love me because for a billionaire media mogul, I'm surprisingly down to earth. Singing on stage with Lionel Richie. I have a lot of Lionel Richie on my iPod, so this was sort of a forced fantasy. At some big birthday party of mine, that 40th in Hawaii, let's say, Lionel is a longtime family friend who surprises me by coming to perform. At some point, he pulls me on stage and we sing together. I can't actually sing well in real life, but in this scenario, I crush dancing on the ceiling. Later, as an encore, we do a haunting duet of Hello, and years later, friends will still recall, "Geez, Rachel, do you remember that one time you and Lionel sang Hello?" Ryan Gosling or a Hemsworth brother. I am far too much of a weenie to have any real fantasies about these guys, but I do like dreaming about some situation where I look flawless and am so totally hilarious and witty that one of these stallions can't help but hit on me. Propriety forces me to tell Ryan slash Chris slash Liam that I'm happily married, but the dream of them asking will still be with me when I'm 90 years old. Some fantasies are instrumental in helping us to reach our goals. Some fantasies are silly, but they give us something to think about. If you ask me, all of them have value, and your fantasies will be different from mine. Maybe you cure a rare disease or have dinner with Oprah. Maybe you talk politics with Roosevelt or try on dresses with Edith Head. The point is, you don't think about the challenge before you. You keep your eyes above the waves. So stop laughing at my nerdiness and find whatever motivation you need to get out there today and make some moves. Things that helped me. Number one, writing it down. I cannot stress this enough. When it comes to goal setting, it's imperative that you write everything down. Okay, maybe not your Matt Damon-related goals. I was a teenager, you guys. But if you're dreaming of something for yourself, physically writing down the words is a powerful thing to do. Number two, saying it out loud. Naming your goals is also important because often we struggle to even admit them to ourselves. Make sure when you name yours, you do it in a powerful way. Say, "I am getting my master's in organizational psychology," instead of, "I will try to go back to school." I drive around town saying my goals in my car where no one can hear me. I announce them like proclamations, as if it's only a matter of time before they happen. Number three, creating a vision board. The pictures inside my closet hold a lot of meaning for me. They're a constant reminder of where I want to go, and a visual aid can be really helpful for those of you who don't feel like your imagination is strong. Use someone else's visuals to help you map out your dreams in your mind. Chapter 14. The lie? I'm a terrible writer. After I published my first book, Party Girl, I would occasionally read every 11 seconds, check Goodreads to see what people were saying about it. As a massive book nerd who devours online reviews in order to build my TBR pile, it felt so exciting to read other people's reviews of a book I had written. It was such an incredible boost for me, especially as I fought my way through writing the sequel, to see the lovely things readers were saying. I was driven to tears more than once by some sweet fan explaining exactly why she loved my characters, all as I'm thinking, yes, that is exactly what I hoped you'd see in her. I lived in this dream world for months. I honestly didn't even know any other reality existed. Then one day, it suddenly ended. I got my first bad review. It's hard to explain exactly how it felt to see someone giving my work 2 stars. But I liken it to being punched in the stomach, then the face, then the stomach again. I entered the early stages of what I like to call critique grief. The first is, obviously, denial. I read her review, and then I read it again. Turns out, no matter how many times I read it, she still thought my work was trite and ridiculous. Next up, in real life grief stages, it would be anger. But for critique grief, at least for me, believing the bad stuff was so much easier than believing the good. Nah, no anger for me. I went right on to bargaining. The first idea in my people-pleasing brain was to comment and try to get her to understand my intentions with the work. Better yet, maybe I could find a way to befriend her. Because surely if we became social media acquaintances and then social media besties, then she would know me and therefore better understand my writing. Surely then she wouldn't have disliked it quite so much. I felt sick to my stomach as I slipped into the last stage of critique grief, acceptance. I decided if this unknown woman was right, maybe everyone else was too easy on my book because it was a debut novel. Maybe this one person was a better judge and I was, in fact, a terrible writer. I was spiraling. In the midst of it, I heard that little voice in my head that helps me out in times of crazy. No, not God, or Jiminy Cricket, or even my inner self. The voice in my head is my therapist, Denise. God bless her. Years ago, Denise told a younger, much more anxiety-ridden me, "Someone else's opinion of you is none of your business." Let me say that again for the people in the cheap seats. Someone else's opinion of me is none of my business. Someone else's opinion of you is none of your business. Those words are so powerful for anyone who tends to hold other people's opinions ahead of their own. And they are never more profound than when we're creating something. Maybe it's a book, a blog, a company, a piece of art, or your fashion sense. When you're creating something from your heart, you do it because you can't not do it. You produce it because you believe your creation deserves to be out in the world. You work and work, and then you close your eyes and cross your fingers and hope it finds recognition. But here's the thing about that magical, mystical thing you're making. You create it because you have a God-given ability to do so. You create as a gift to yourself and to the higher power who blessed you with those abilities. But you can't make people like or understand it. You have to be willing to put it out there, even if they don't like it, even if they hate it, even if they give you 2 stars or none at all. You have to understand that every person on earth has an opinion, and their opinion, even if they're the most widely recognized expert on the subject, only has bearing on your work if you let it. A mean review cannot make me a bad writer. Can I write terribly? Oh, heck yes. The first, second, and third draft of everything I write is basically garbage. If I refuse to take constructive criticism from an editor I trust, if I don't push myself to grow as a writer, if I regurgitate the same story over and over, or worse, if I try to impersonate someone else's style, then yes, there is a good chance my work is going to suck. But deciding that something is bad simply because other people don't like or understand it is not a theory I can co-sign. Art and creativity are so subjective, and dang it, it's hard to find the courage and drive to complete anything. So, sister, if you're going to work that hard on a project, do you really want to allow it to be blown apart by something as flimsy as an opinion? As an artist or creator, you have to decide. You have to choose a path or live the rest of your life slowly killing your ability to do great work for fear of what others will think. You have to decide that you care more about creating your magic and pushing it out into the world than you do about how it will be received. This task is much easier said than done. As I sit writing this chapter in my favorite local coffee shop, I've checked my other browser approximately 30 times. This morning, I posted an article on a website I've contributed to for years, but today I decided to talk about something a tad bit controversial. At least, it's outside of the kind of post I'm typically known for. And so I'm wondering, will anyone get it? Will it find a home and an audience? Or worse yet, will it make anyone mad? Even after years of putting myself out there, I still get caught up in the lie that I might be a terrible writer or that I should create or not based on whether I have an audience for it. I start to believe that I need public opinion to validate my desire to make something, when the truth is, I should embrace my creativity because it's a God-given ability. Anytime I try something new, I will have to fight off the desire to confirm that it will be loved in order to keep going. Since I anticipate being creative and trying new things for as long as I'm living, that could mean decades of occasionally being trapped by unhelpful anxieties. What a waste of energy. Would I rather bottle up my creative thoughts and ideas? No. I hope they find a home, even if they only resonate with a handful of people. So then I have to ask myself if I would be willing to risk a negative response if my work resonated positively with others. What if only one person gets it, but everyone else hates it? What if nobody loves it at all? Would it be worth it even then? Yes. My answer is yes. I would rather put my work out there, no matter what the response will be. I would rather create in celebration of the fact that I have the ability to do so. For me, the answer is to create. That is always the answer. My personal form of creation is writing, especially writing words I hope other people will read. So I have two choices. I can write down words and send them out into the world and hope they find a home. Or I can hide my light under a bushel because I'm too afraid someone won't like the glare. I choose this. I choose to sit in coffee shops and on airplanes and at my kitchen counter writing. I choose to squeeze in minutes between soccer practice or before sunrise or long after everyone else in the house is asleep to type and type and type until I stream enough sentences together to make a book. I have no idea if you'll love it or hate it. Obviously, I hope you dig the heck out of it and buy 100 copies for all your friends. But even if you don't, I'll still be here. I started at this desk alone, without an audience to read my work. I'll stay here as long as I've got words jumbling around in my head, whether or not there's anyone to receive them. When I was a little girl, I spent every Sunday, and most other days, at the small First Assembly of God church where my daddy was the pastor. Our song service included Mama on the piano and a handful of tambourines sprinkled throughout the room. We were simultaneously off-key and in three-part harmony in a way only a small country church can pull off. As I got older, I experienced the sedate musicality of a large Presbyterian congregation, the joy of an inner-city gospel choir, and the theatrics of a megachurch. I've been to tiny prayer meetings in Ethiopia where I couldn't understand a single word but felt every one of them. I've spent hours upon hours of my life singing and clapping in church, and this is what I've come to discover. Writing, for me, is its own kind of worship. The definition of worship is the feeling of expression or reverence for a deity. Creating is the greatest expression of reverence I can think of because I recognize that the desire to make something is a gift from God. The freedom to carve out the time and have a safe place to create that art is a blessing of the highest level in a world where so many people are unable to have either. Every time I indulge in the art of creation without worrying about what the public will think of it is craft in its purest form. And craft can be any old thing at all. For me, it's writing. For you, it might be painting, making quilts, or taking a Thursday night ballet class. Whether or not something is good or worthy is up for interpretation. And if you're unconcerned about other people's interpretation, then everything you make is fantastic. I hope you'll remember this in your own life, and I hope you'll create for yourself. Do it in celebration of your ability to do so, regardless of what anyone else thinks. Things that helped me. Number one, I stopped reading reviews. This is a big deal, you guys. I have no idea what you think of anything I've written since that bad review on Party Girl so many years ago. Maybe you love my books. Maybe you use them for kindling. Either way, it doesn't affect my desire to keep writing more. Everyone gets reviewed. Even if you're just asking for the opinion of your judgmental sister and being torn apart by her response, do something daring this year and stop reading your version of reviews. Number two, I write for myself. I write fiction about girls falling in love in Los Angeles. I write cookbooks about cheese-based dips. Now, here I am writing a nonfiction book about the struggles and triumphs in my life. This makes no earthly sense. Authors write in one or two genres, and they build up clout in a handful of areas. Here's the bottom line. Writing is my art, my creative outlet. It is literally my lifelong dream come true, and therefore, I hold it sacred. It never has been and never will be my job. I don't need it to make money to be valuable. This is an important distinction for me because I never want the creative choices I'm making to be based on money or business rather than whatever is on my heart and in my head. If you have it within your power to keep a piece of your creativity just for yourself, it is truly a gift. Number three, I indulge in silliness. I color with my boys, I draw on the ground with sidewalk chalk, I watch YouTube videos about how to do shimmery, smoky eyes, and try to replicate it even if I have nowhere to go. I reach for silly, creative endeavors that serve no real purpose other than joy. Chapter 15. The lie? I will never get past this. Since I'm talking about the hard things I've battled and conquered in the stretch of my life, I would be remiss to leave out the one thing I didn't think I could overcome. Anyone who's ever been through something truly traumatic, regardless of how the repercussions have manifested, deserves to hear that they're not alone. There are many types of trauma, big, small, childhood, adult, but we all belong to a club we never asked to join. We find solidarity in numbers, in hearing other stories. And this is mine. My big brother Ryan was funny and unfailingly kind. He had an almost prodigious ability to pick up any instrument and teach himself to play it by ear within the span of a single day. He was handsome. I didn't know it then because I was younger and not inclined to think about it, but when I look back at photos now and see his cocky grin and his startling blue eyes, I realize how good-looking he was. When I was a young girl, he was my best friend and constant playmate. I can still see the two of us vividly in my memory, staying up late in our room playing the alphabet game. My name is Carla. I'm going to California to sell crab apples. My name is David. I'm going to Delaware to sell dogs. As an adolescent, he was my protector. He taught me how to handle a bully, how to throw a punch, and how to thread a ramen noodle through my nose and out my mouth. He wasn't necessarily better or worse than anyone else's big brother, but he was mine, and I loved him. He was my big brother until I was about 12 years old, when his mental illness took over. He took his own life before I turned 15. I know the reality of that sentence is heavy, but here I am, admitting the worst of the worst, the ugly truth about my brother's disease and the destruction of the family it left behind. I don't know any way to the other side of this conversation without trudging through it. I don't know any other way to offer solidarity to others who've gone through their own trauma without describing my own. Not many people want to share that a member of their family was borderline schizophrenic. Not many people want to tell you that their sibling was severely depressed and obsessive-compulsive, going through multiple doctors and countless mood-stabilizing medications before he was even old enough to get a learner's permit. Very few people would tell you that in his worst moment, my big brother got access to a handgun and left the discovery of his body to me. I don't want to talk about the nightmares that came afterwards, or the crippling fear that I experienced. For years afterward, I assumed every sleeping person, sitting person, unmoving person I encountered must be dead too. I don't want to talk about how when some well-meaning family members came to clean up his room, they covered the bloody wall with the only paint we had on hand that day. I don't want to tell you that because of that, seeing silver spray paint still makes me sick to my stomach. I don't want to tell you about the horrific images that are seared into my brain or the guilt I carry to this day because I was too afraid to sit with his body until the paramedics arrived. I don't want to talk about all of the therapy I had to sit through as a scared 14-year-old or an angry 17-year-old or as an adult grappling with the idea that I needed to make up the difference for his loss. I don't want to tell you about how many times I have obsessively planned out the funeral of my husband or my children as a sick coping mechanism for my fear that something could happen to them too. I don't want to tell you about any of these hidden, ugly, dark truths, but I will. I will tell you about my trauma in some of its gruesome detail because I want you to know that there was a time when I didn't think I could wade through it. There was a time when even with my future stretched out in front of me, all I could see was blood and fear and loss. But I am still here. And so are you. I am still here because I refuse to let anything or anyone decide what I get to have. I am still here because I refuse to let my trauma have the last word. I am still here because I will not let a nightmare have more power than my dreams. I am still here because I didn't allow the hard time to make me weak. I willed it to make me strong. Recently, I was watching Tony Robbins' documentary, I'm Not Your Guru, and he said, if you're going to blame your hard times for all the things that are wrong in your life, you better also blame them for the good stuff too. I was stunned to have something tangible to explain the way I have felt about my brother's death. You're not supposed to acknowledge the good things that came out of trauma. There's something perverse and unhealthy about it. It seems wrong to look for any silver lining because that means appreciating something terrible that happened to you. But I recognize now that if you don't look for the good that came out of what you lived through, it's all wasted. I would give nearly anything to have my brother with us, to know him whole and healthy. To lose him was so devastating I could easily have allowed it to destroy me. What happened to my nerves, my sleep, my sense of safety, and worse, my sense of trust because of having seen him that way, might have totally crippled me. Instead, I flipped the narrative inside my mind. Even as a teenager, I used to think, you can do this, Rachel. You can do anything. Think of what you've lived through already. When I moved to Los Angeles at 17, where I didn't know anyone or anything and could barely afford to survive, I refused to give in to fear. Sleeping in a crappy apartment, living off food from the 99-cent store, and barely making rent weren't ever truly scary. I'd lived through real terror, and I knew the difference. When I was in my 51st hour of labor with my first baby, and I was weak with exhaustion, my internal monologue reminded me how strong I was. You were forged in a fire worse than this. You've stood with death, and you are certainly strong enough to help bring life into being. I've run marathons. I've built companies. I've pushed myself and my career to places further than other people might have believed possible. And the entire time, I knew I was capable of it because I knew I'd already lived through worse. Maybe if you haven't lived through anything hard, you find the idea obtuse or even Machiavellian. But what is the alternative? We live through something crappy and that's it? We're done for? We allow the hard, ugliest parts of our lives to color everything else? You cannot ignore your pain. You cannot ever leave it behind completely. The only thing you can do is find a way to embrace the good that came out of it, even if it takes you years to discover what that is. Losing my brother was the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my life, but it does not define my life. You can live through something that rocks your world off its axis. You can survive losing a piece of your heart without losing the core of who you are. More than merely surviving the loss, you can thrive. You can do it because it's what you deserve. More importantly, you can survive the loss because living is the greatest honor you can give to the person you lost, even if the person who's gone was your younger, more innocent self. The path through hardship or extreme trauma is one of the most difficult things a being can encounter. But make no mistake, the only way is to fight through it. Pain and trauma are a violent whirlpool, and they will drag you under if you don't battle to stay afloat. There will be times, especially in the beginning, when it will take everything within you to keep your head above those waves. But you must keep your head above the waves. It's so difficult, but you are tough. Even if you don't feel it at the time, the very fact that you're still breathing in and out means you're fighting back against the tide that wants to sweep you away. Don't let it. After a while, I promise it will become easier to tread water, and finally you'll learn to swim against the current. The friction you'll face will build your muscles, bones, and sinew. The very fabric of your being will be shaped by this journey. The toughest one you've ever taken, surely, but you will become something greater because of it. You have to. Otherwise, what was the point? I used to naively say that everything happens for a reason, but that was only because I hadn't yet lived through something horrific enough to bring that statement into question. I don't believe everything happens for a specific reason, but I do believe it's possible to find purpose even in the absence of explanation. Things that helped me. Number one, going to therapy. I know I've already mentioned this, but in this instance, it's worth repeating. I cannot fathom how I would have survived all that I have without the help of a trusted therapist. The process wasn't fun or easy, and I often hated sitting on a couch week after week reliving the trauma. But if I hadn't done that work, it would still be haunting me. Number two, talking about it. Not just with a therapist, but with at least one other person you trust. When we were first married, I sat down one night and told Dave everything about the day Ryan died. Details that had been locked inside my head for 6 years all fell into the sacred space between us. He didn't try to fix it or organize it or adjust it in any way. He listened, and in doing so, willingly took my pain inside himself and made the load lighter to bear. Number three, made myself think about it. Right after Ryan died, I really struggled with nightmares and obsessing over the images in my head. An extremely wise